Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Well, what a week. What a day it was. We're recording this a little bit late.
Yeah, it's my fault. I'll take the blame for that one.
Okay. Well, and I was inflexible because I was traveling, so, you know, it happens.
Yep. From time to time, we do not obey the directives of Calendar. We go rogue.
No, we got a pass from Calendar today.
Thank God.
The great.
By thank God, I mean thank Calendar.
Yeah, and specifically that one said that we could wait a little bit. I did a chart this week. I did the fiscal year charts, which I think are fun. I'm not sure if anybody else does, but I think they're fun. And it really puts Apple's last year in perspective. Like that revenue chart of Apple's revenue through history from 99 on, and you see the huge leap that it took this year.
Money.
It's just a lot.
It's the thing that makes me like roll my eyes that much more about analysts being like, oh, they missed their mark. I'm like, but they made so much money. They made more money than Calendar, and they still can't make these people happy. So I mean, it's funny to me because it is such a game of we're gonna pick a number and we need you to hit, like, guess that number basically. and it's like, well, but does it matter? Is that number important? It's like, no, it's just the number we picked. It's the number we think's important. Okay.
Yeah. Still, the numbers are huge. The Mac number is the one that got me too, because they say, you know, there's one thing when you say it's been the four best Mac quarters ever, but then you see the number of $35 billion in revenue when the previous high was last year and it was 29. It's like, oh,
I like. It's too bad that your chart. Yeah, it's too bad your chart only goes back to 1997, because I really kind of want to see the.
Well, just imagine a series of small numbers.
94 numbers, yeah.
A series of numbers below three for the previous 13 years.
Probably not even billions. I think.
Probably not for a while.
Like,
yeah, no. I think 2 years ago I did a version of this chart. Sort of like to wrap up the decade, even though, you know, obviously the fiscal decade had wrapped up a couple months before, but I didn't do it then. I did it the beginning of 2020. And what was funny is I looked at the decade of the Mac. And if you look at this chart from 97 to 21, and you look at the decade of the 2010s, it actually looks really stagnant, right? It starts at 22, and then when I did it in 2020, it went to 26. And it's sort of like 22, 23, 21, 24, 25, 23, 26, 25, 26. And it's sort of like, okay, the Mac's doing better than ever. And you can see it on this chart that it was a steady climb from 3 in 2001 up to 22 in 2010. But then after that steady climb, it sort of hung around. But you take the last 2 years, which were not in this chart when I did it in January of 2020. If you take fiscal 20 and 21, it went from 26 to 29 to 35. It's like
35 is a big number for the Mac. I mean,
you know, you could ascribe some of it to some COVID related stuff, making a buying cycle happen sooner than it should have and brought a bunch of stuff forward, I guess. But that's a huge leap. It's just an enormous leap. And I think we'll see what happens. The future will tell the tale, but it certainly feels like the Mac has shifted gears yet again.
That the combination of COVID and the Apple Silicon transition.
Apple Silicon,
I think
Apple would tell you it's all about the M1, but
sure.
I think it's a little bit of both.
I think it's, I mean, the pandemic is a fingers crossed once in a lifetime kind of thing, right? And it's, you know, that drove sales, I think, in a way that it is contextual, right? Like, you have this situational thing where this thing happens and it peaks your sales, right? And I think it's hard to ascribe that to anything else that would be just sort of normal. I think without that, in normal Apple Silicon times, I bet they would have gotten a nice bump out of it, but I don't think they would have gotten that large a jump out of it, certainly.
But yeah, well, and the sales started to spike, obviously, before the M1 came out, right? They were selling a lot of laptops in early 2020, early and mid-2020.
Certainly having those two things happen at the same time, I think, you know, it has its upsides and downsides, right? Its upsides are people need computers, and those computers are better than ever. The downsides are we're doing a processor transition, which means we are supply limited, right? And in a time when the supply chain is undergoing problems. So now we have this great problem to have, as they so often say, which is we cannot build these computers fast enough because it happened to catch us at a time when we're shifting all our processes and trying to put in those leading edge nodes. And just sort of, you know.
Legacy nodes,
yeah.
Legacy nodes.
I think it's interesting to see the confluence of those events because, you know, Apple obviously planned to do this chip transition well in advance of knowing there was a pandemic, probably. But then, you know, world events, they got in the way. But the end result, it kind of helped. It was interesting to see that in the, you know, obviously the talking about the iPad is sort of in a similar but different situation, right? Like, that's an interesting one, too.
It had its, like, wild time in 12, 13, 14. And so the chart looks like this sort of saddle almost, where, like, it was up and then it went down.
Yeah.
And now it's back up, right? Now it's now it's back to $32 billion. It is actually the best fiscal year of the iPad's history.
But it will
be. And just to be keep in mind, previously it was 2013. It went down, 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 down year by year. And then the last 3 years, it's gone up, up, way up.
Yeah, fascinating, like, you know, trajectory on that one. I think in addition, throwing in the fact that they talked about on their investor call that the iPad was particularly the one they singled out for supply chain problems.
Right.
That's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out because, you know, this is, as you just said, this is something where it seems to have gotten like this nice bump, but they're very quickly, you know, potentially not going to be able to meet demand if the demand is still very high, and I expect it will be. So that's going to be interesting to see how that. But you know, they've decided they're in the iPad business for the long haul, right? Like they went through that whole low period, and it's not like they were like, "Nah, the iPad, it was a nice try, but we're going to throw it out," right? Like kind of like they did with the HomePod. They decided the iPad had legs, and there was places for it to go. And certainly, I would be hard pressed to point to the thing that I feel like improved the iPad. Like, why did it start rebounding?
I think so. My theory is it's a combination of people having long in the tooth iPads, sure, but also of Apple getting its story together. And when it was at the bottom, right, as it was going down and then when it reached the bottom, that's when Apple pulled out the iPad Pro. Then it did it brought back the iPad Air. It released that new low-end iPad, because remember the adjectiveless iPad didn't exist for a couple of years until they did that Chicago event and introduced the Pencil and did the new iPad. So I feel like they didn't introduce the Pencil. They introduced the Pencil with the iPad Pro, but they made it a Pencil-compatible lower-end iPad. It was that moment where it took them years to do it, but like there were several moments along the way, especially that Chicago event, where they like said, okay, we're going to uncouple the iPad here and we're going to make a low-end cheap iPad and we're going to make a high-end awesome iPad. And then ultimately some in the middle. And I think that that is a big reason why the iPad has been much more successful. I think it's partially cyclical, but I think partially it's that it was kind of confusing and that Apple was kind of pushing the iPad up without having any option down below it. Like I was happy in 2015 as it's on its slide that they did the first iPad Pro. But like it was a weird time where I think that line was not clearly defined. And although it's still a little bit messy even to this day, it's they're like, you got so many different buying options in the iPad now that you didn't have then, including a very good entry-level model.
Yeah, that entry-level model, I think you're right. That makes having that and then the Pro, we could talk of, it's got a kind of squishy middle to it right now, but that having the 329 model and the, you know, iPad Pros, which are for very different markets, right? Like, you're not going to get a lot of people who come in and be like, should I buy a $329 entry-level iPad or an iPad Pro? You have some people who are like, well, am I buying the iPad Air or that entry-level iPad or the iPad Air or iPad Pro? But the top and the bottom of that lineup are very well differentiated. And I agree, having that there, as opposed to it just being like, well, there's, you know, for a long time at the beginning, there was just the iPad, right? It was a product. And it was different, you know, different storage tiers or whatever, but like there was only one model. And so trying to sort of split that off and fork it to a high end and a low end, I think probably helped them a lot because all the people who are like, I just want something literally a consumption device, right? You know, can do a bunch of other things, but like, I just want this $300 device that I can watch the TV and surf the web and send my emails on. That's a great way to get them in, right? I think, and as opposed to scaring them off, and it certainly, I think, competes much better against the Android tablet market, which has always been kind of a mess and non-existent, but it was cheap, right? Yeah, so like having that argument, like, well, sure, you could go pay $150 for a Android tablet or whatever, or you could pay $300, get an iPad, and you know what that means, right? Like, you know the cachet that has around it.
Right. Yeah. But you could still reach it with at a much more reasonable price maybe than it was before.
No. No.
You wrote about the it's Friday afternoon, people.
Yeah.
The Monterey screensaver. Somebody wrote in to say that so you found a 3D file.
I didn't buy it. I want to credit the reader Joseph who is DMing me a bunch about this and was very excited about it. And I sort of poked into it a little bit, but didn't have a chance to write it up until now. But yeah, he found this very interesting thing inside the Monterey screensaver.
And it sounds like reader Matt looked at the file in 3D software and said the file name is actually *Canyon_Geo43_optimized. So it's probably a scan, he said, of Star Canyon, which is in Santa Clara County. It's not an underwater canyon. It's just a canyon sort of to the east of northeast of Gilroy, east of Morgan Hill. It's in the hills. If there is a Star Canyon there anyway, if that's the Star Canyon they mean. But it looks to me like what they did is, in order to maybe to make reference to the Monterey Undersea Canyon, they found some nice topographic data and built some camera paths because you found that file, and that screensaver is a little less of a canned artistic thing and a little bit more of actually kind of based on an actual topo map.
It's clever. I mean, it's cool, right? Like, 'cause at first glance, I don't think anybody necessarily would be like, oh, it's just sort of weird, like shifting patterns or something. But the idea that it feels tremendously over-engineered. Like, well, we got this whole 3D model. Yeah. We run a camera through it. Like, you know, then we're running, you know, probably a bunch of filters and stuff on the top of that. It's very Apple-like. To be like, sure, it looks very simple, but this is actually what it is. And there was in the thread, I think I updated to a link to Joseph's thread talking about this, and there was somebody from Apple who chimed in there to be kind of coy about like, oh, yeah, it does kind of look like a canyon, doesn't it? So it is clearly some sort of, 3D model of an actual thing, but it's very cool. I don't know exactly what it is. I thought about reaching out to, there is a organization in Monterey Bay, is it the aquarium? It may be the aquarium. The Aquarium Research, Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, which does a bunch of 3D mapping of stuff and has like subs and things. Because they must have gotten this data from somewhere was the thing that occurred to me.
Either that or they faked it with topo data from somewhere else. But it's inspired by Monterey Canyon.
Yeah.
But just another canyon, and maybe they scaled up the vertical in order to make it seem more impressive, or I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Right.
But it's a cool idea that there's a 3D file in there, and you're right, that is the Apple doing like super extra. Like, why did you do
that? Yes, why is this not just a shifting color screensaver?
Yeah,
I don't know, because we can. I mean, it's like, as I compared it to, it reminded me a lot of the Arial screensavers, right? It's sort of like a stylized version of those, right? Where it does the flyovers on your Apple TV and like takes you through various little places and different landscapes and stuff like that. But it's got a very much the same energy to that.
The where was it that I saw? Somebody pointed out that it was Stephen Hackett pointed out on 512 Pixels that somebody came up with a Monterey active desktop wallpaper because Apple didn't do a photographic representation of Monterey for macOS Monterey. So these guys, and it's vyncher.com, these guys went out and shot a location, scouted locations, found a location in Monterey, and then shot pictures all day and generated a dynamic wallpaper that you can download. It's pretty awesome.
That is pretty cool. I am a big fan of the stylized ones that Apple put in Big Sur. Mm-hmm. That are the dynamic ones that are the illustrations. I really enjoy those. That is an aesthetic that really works for me. And I was sad they didn't include more of those this time around. The ones that kind of have that. I use one called the Cliffs. That goes through different, like it's sort of along the coast there, and it goes through different times of day and all that. And I really enjoy that. But yeah, I want them to keep going on with that aesthetic, which I really dig.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Good stuff on your desktop. So thank you for spelunking through files.
I did very little, but I did a little bit.
Hey, speaking of Stephen Hackett, he wrote the member piece this week about basically saying, hey, remember the colorful iBook? Maybe the new MacBook Air could be like that. It's just a kind of nice, like, give us the colors, have it be more fun, like give us those iMac, new 24-inch iMac colors. Wouldn't that be nice? Let's do that. And I co-sign that, I think.
Yeah.
That's the right place to do that. And, you know, and do a silver one too. That's fine. But give people some color options. I think that would be a lot of fun.
I never had one of the colorful iBooks. They came out around the time I considered that, but I think I got a PowerBook at the time instead. But I always thought they were cool looking. I enjoyed the colorful nature of them. And mm-hmm. I agree. I think that there's a lot, we've talked a lot about color and fun and all that stuff. And I think it's something for Apple to lean into. I mean, they've leaned into how powerful all their computers are. And I mean, I've seen the, we were talking somewhere else about commercials that we see a lot. And I've seen the new MacBook Pro commercial several times on a couple of the streaming services I watch. And yeah. They like, you know, they're really into like showing off the ports and how cool it is and everything. And I'm like, I'm here for this. It's great. I'm impressed with the amount of power you put into that. But let's not neglect personality. Personality is still an important mm-hmm. component of at least Apple's identity as a computer maker,
sure.
If not the computer industry at large.
You know, the Apple ad I hate right now is the Apple Watch ad. With
I've seen this a million times.
I've seen it a million times.
And oh, my God.
And what I don't... Honestly, by the time I get to the end, I am just angry. But the part of it that I don't like is the guy who crashes through three different scenes taking his ECG.
Yeah.
Because on one level, like, there's this implication of like, oh, you're taking an ECG, where we know that it's sort of like Apple's like, this doesn't mean anything for most people and yeah. don't use this and all of that. But then the really kind of hacky, let's make it exciting by having him crash down through different mm-hmm. scenes, which doesn't make any sense. And the last one, they can't, you know, there's no roof to crash down through or something. So if you watch that ad 30 times, you'll notice that when he's at the swimming pool, he just like bounces his head like, oh, look, I just landed here, but it's super fake. I hate that ad so much. So by the time they get to the people who are climbing the mountains and are in the tent, and he's like,
it's the blood oxygen one that gets me every
yeah.
single time.
It makes me so
like,
angry. Oh,
I don't
why?
Even, yeah, I don't. Again, a thing that is. This is a thing that Apple has really struggled with the Apple Watch is that line between this is a I don't even know what to call it, a wellness device, but not like a medical device. Like they've really had to walk that line of like we give you this power, but we can't tell you that you can actually do anything with it because it's not approved. And it may not be accurate, right? Like in certain cases, there were a lot of things about the blood oxygen sensor when it came out in terms of how accurate it actually was. And I kind of felt like maybe they'd back away from it a little bit and just at least not show it, you know, so prominently.
Yeah,
but
I know,
nope, they decided to just go with it. And I'm like, that's an interesting choice.
Yeah, I don't like that ad at all. There are other ads that I hate more, but that's the Apple ad that I don't like.
I thought the original version they did during the Apple Watch event was fine, but now that I've seen it a billion times,
in that 30-second version,
yeah.
I don't need to ever see that again.
Yep.
Fortunately, the baseball playoffs are over now, so I never have to see those ads ever again. It's very rare that I see ads. It's always in sports, and they make me want to hide under a blankie somewhere.
What a world.
I should mention Stephen Hackett. This was the last Hackett file for Six Colors because he wants to focus a little more on 512. And he's been doing it for like, I think he's been writing those for like 3 years now, something like that. It's been a long time.
It's hard to write columns a lot too. So, I mean, I'm glad that he's managed to do that every month because we both know how that can be.
It is tricky and difficult and all that. So we're going to get some new people. We've already talked to some people whose names you may know, but to write some things, and whether that'll be ongoing or we'll do a bunch of one shots is sort of like remains to be seen. But so there'll be some new names in the purple posts, the weekly purple posts. Ooh, purple at the top of the newsletter every week. So just for a little show note, housekeeping kind of thing.
Very exciting.
While we were waiting to record, I wrote a nice post. So TJ Luoma alerted me to the fact that this guy Drew Kerr responded to a post I made on the Automators forum saying, how the heck is there any way to have a script detect what focus mode you're in? And he found a way. It actually looks at some files in the Do Not Disturb folder of your library folder and does some JSON parsing.
So weird.
But it
works.
Again, I say one, Apple, this should just be in shortcuts. It should be in, there should be a command line utility that, why? Also, secondarily to that, it would be nice to be able to set the focus mode via a script.
Yeah.
But at least you can use this. It's a JavaScript. I think you use JavaScript for automation, basically because it's easier to parse JSON in JavaScript than it is to do an Apple script. Take it from me. Somebody who's tried to parse JSON in Apple script, it's no good. So he just uses JavaScript, but you can save it out. And there's a run JavaScript with automation action in shortcuts on the Mac. Mm. And you just paste a script in. And when you press play, it tells you the focus mode. And you're like, oh. So you could set up a script that checks every 5 minutes to see if you're in a focus mode and does some stuff every minute, whatever. And that's really interesting. So that was my Friday afternoon waiting for the podcast to start. Quick thing that I did. And thank you to TJ and thank you to Drew because that totally worked. And I'm very impressed. That's like, I didn't know where to look for it because Do Not Disturb used to be stored somewhere else, but it's not there anymore. It moved locations. So I'm happy to have, that Drew tracked it down.
Yeah. I was playing with shortcuts today too, because one of our other readers was talking about like making it easier to get the name of a web page using an action, and like, I believe that it's possible, but I could not figure out how to do it. And it's like a lot of stuff like that where it feels like, oh, Apple, like, I'm glad, again, we've talked about this before. Shortcuts, they've claimed, is a process. There is more stuff going to happen. They've committed to doing this sort of longer term, and that's great. But there's definitely a bunch of stuff that is within the OS that should be accessible via automation that is not. And I'm glad that you found one for focus. I still bring up desktop spaces because I think it's bizarre that they can't address that anywhere.
I'm gonna give more it actions. To them as this is why they said it's a transition, is now that they've got shortcuts up and running on the Mac, one of the things they need to do is actually start tying things in, and that's partially on the shortcuts team, because something like this could just be an action that they do and it would work.
Sure.
But it's also on the makers of ancillary parts of Mac OS.
Where
the shortcuts team has to go, you need to give us a way to find this.
Right. I think
you
it's
need
funny.
To,
yeah,
you
yeah.
Need to do this,
it's very funny too, because I think there was a time where AppleScript was so prevalent for a while in like every part of the OS and deep reaching, and then it started to die off a little bit. And Automator came, and Automator wasn't as wide reaching, but like there's a bunch of other features that were developed in Mac OS as automation was kind of backburnered, and so a lot of that stuff I feel like is not accessible just because like automation wasn't a thing that people were thinking about.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden,
exactly it.
All of a sudden, automation's become hot again, and you're like, well, we have 10 years of features that we didn't design to be automatable. We got to play some catch up there. Yeah, so I agree. I think that would be fantastic. I'm hopeful that it means that there will be a lot more stuff that's available to the Mac shortcuts, because there's so much power there potentially.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm
just really excited by it. And seeing more and more third-party developers starting to build automation stuff into their into their apps is awesome. I'm very excited.
We can't talk about the details, but you and I both used a beta this week that is a new, basically a Mac app that's been around a while that wasn't scriptable, and there is the hints of automation are leaking into it, and it's like that wouldn't have happened without Apple saying, okay,
absolutely not.
User automation on the Mac. Yeah, we really are going to do it, and here's shortcuts and all of that. And so I'm very encouraged. Nobody play the guessing game. We're not going to tell you what it is. But and I've actually got more than one example of a Mac app that I've seen that I'm like, oh, look what you did, right? Like, there's a change. There's a little bit of a change happening. It's very exciting.
I'm intrigued by some apps too that include their own scripting stuff and like looking for like I'm thinking Acorn in particular is one that pops in mind because I think they use a bunch of JavaScript for automation in there. I was like, oh, well, that's ripe for like at least having some sort of pass through to just be like, well, oh, let's put a thing in there.
Omni Group's apps all have JavaScript automation built in, and they just released an update. This is one of the ones I was going to use as an example. They just released an update that adds shortcut actions, which let you run a script or a plugin from Omni automation stuff. Mm-hmm. So they built a JavaScript automation system internally, but then you can reach into it from the outside and then connect it all up, which is good stuff.
Yeah, a lot of great stuff there. And I'm very excited about the possibilities of that because I actually have not rehooked up my Stream Deck. It's sitting here. It's just not plugged into the Mac right now. But like, I'm very excited about the possibilities of getting more stuff working with that at some point down the road here.
Same. All right. Well, that's this week. A little late, but better late than never, I think.
It's my motto.
Yeah. Well, at least for this week. Next week may be new motto. Who knows?
Yeah.
But until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.